Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode. Instead of reviewing the week's top stories, today we'll look back at the 2024 legislative session. Lawmakers adjourned almost a month ago after 160 days. Governor Hobbs did not set a new record for vetoes as she did last session, but there still were plenty of controversial measures that were debated. I sat down earlier this week with Paul Bentz of High Ground and Gael Esposito of Creosote Partners to talk about this year's session, and I started by asking Gael what stood out when thinking about this year's legislative session.
Yeah, I still haven't caught up on sleep yet. This was one of the more chaotic sessions I've ever been a part of. Beyond the issues that were covered, you had record numbers of resignations, indictments, investigations. It was just an exceptional session in so many bad ways and in a handful of good ways where we saw some real big policy wins.
Paul, what do you think?
I think chaos was the right description of it, not only with the resignations and the investigations, but when you go from having a surplus to having a deficit, a $1.8 billion deficit to deal with, it makes it much more challenging. You know, you're not handing out money and not everybody's getting the Oprah treatment. Stipend. You get a stipend. So to actually have to make cuts certainly makes it more challenging as well.
So I should mention for those who celebrate, we passed the fiscal year. So happy fiscal year, new fiscal year to all who celebrate this past year. Gael, do you think that the chaos was it mostly the turnover with the number of new people coming in midstream in the second year of a 2-year term? Were there other factors that led to that?
I think that may be part of it. I think the biggest factor is still the growing pains of divided government with legislators on both sides of the aisle who are not used to that power dynamic. And with the growing far-right extremism in the Republican Party and the dominance of those far-right members within those caucuses, it made it a lot harder to find the balance on policy issues.
And I think, as Paul pointed out with the budget, you know, last year, I don't want to say it was easy, but it certainly seems like it would be a lot easier to get people to vote for a budget when you're giving them a big pot of money to do so. This year was a lot more difficult, and we saw it really dragged out a lot longer because, as you say, there was this divided government, but also because they kind of had to craft a deficit budget.
Absolutely. And the funny thing was, if they had waited a week longer, they would have had a little bit more money to play with there. Maybe have avoided that whole fight with Attorney General Mays. But, you know, I think there was also beyond just that larger deficit fight, the issue of, once again, the growing pains of how to negotiate a budget with a Democratic governor for Republican leadership and for Democratic members, how to insert themselves and assert themselves within that process effectively. And we saw that happen after the fact, where you saw Democratic members get additional wins within the budget. I think the biggest line item, in my opinion, was that $15 million into the housing trust fund there. But we saw lots of wins like that. You know, but once again, that sort of came at the tail end of the process. So I think we're going to see that dynamic continue to solidify in, you know, depending on how the legislature looks after this election cycle, maybe get a little easier.
Well, so, Paul, when you talk about the budget, you had leaders of the Democratic caucuses in the House who were not happy with it. Some Democratic leaders didn't vote for it. You had some of the more conservative Republicans not voting for it. And as Gael mentioned, there were some sort of last minute additions to, you know, get people on board. Especially compared to last year's budget, what did you make of the process that it took to get to 16 and 31 this year?
Well, it certainly was messier. And I think part of the challenge is, you know, the governor needs to take some leadership and work with her caucuses more. I think that's important, especially if they think they're going to flip one or both of these legislative bodies next year. Giving them that experience, giving them that leadership, equipping them to be a part of the process seems like that would have been a good idea. The other challenge we have is it is a one-vote advantage for Republicans in both House and Senate, but 80% of our legislators, both Republicans and Democrats, are elected in their primaries. Mm-hmm. So there's not a motivation for them to work together to find solutions. I think the big thing that we saw here is on big issues, there are some small victories along the way, but on big issues like water, for example, that the negotiations just don't take place. Some people, they just go into their corners and they stay away from it because they have a constituency that they're serving and that constituency doesn't want to address it.
Well, it's interesting on water because it seems like there had been some hope in January, maybe a little before the session started even, that, you know, there would be some big things happening on water this year. And there were some legislative victories in the area of water, but nothing really big, it seems.
Well, the big issue is the groundwater legislation for the rural parts of Arizona that don't have any regulation. It's why people, you know, dairies from Minnesota and, you know, companies from Saudi Arabia are coming in and sucking the groundwater dry in these areas, is because we're the only state in the West that doesn't have this legislation. And it's being held up, and then it's being bartered with on other water bills to try to hold it up. But just it's not getting done, and it's something that's essential that the majority of the electorate understand. Water is a growing issue that voters recognize and are concerned about. More than 70% of the electorate do not believe we have enough water to last the next 100 years. And if we continue to allow groundwater pumping unlimited, it's going to happen even faster.
Gael, do you think that water legislation, big water legislation on groundwater specifically, was that a victim of the chaos you were talking about earlier, or is there something else at play?
I think in part, but it's funny to me because before the session started, everybody was saying that, you know, we're going to see big action on water, but nothing's really going to happen on housing. And instead, we saw big action on housing and nothing really happened on water. And I think, you know, that is an example of how you can get things done at the legislature when an issue isn't like entirely negatively partisanly sorted yet, right? You know, people aren't fully in their camps. You still have folks you can win over and convince and build weird coalitions around. And so on housing, you saw half the Democratic caucus, half the Republican caucus coming together to get bills to the governor's desk. And hopefully, you know, with water, we start to see a movement. I think it's just going to take a couple more years.
Well, so you mentioned housing. Let me ask you about that, because that was another big issue that a lot of people earlier in the session have been talking about. Last year, of course, there were a few efforts to get some big housing stuff done to increase the stock of available housing, affordable housing in the state. And there were some pretty significant victories, according to the advocates in this area. We saw the casitas, the accessory dwelling units. Mm-hmm. We saw bills dealing with where you can build more density, more, you know, duplexes, triplexes, that sort of thing. How significant will that be, do you think, in the long run?
I think those are really big wins. I, you know, in full disclosure, I worked on those bills. So, of course, I think they're very big wins. I think those issues are ones that we saw in other states take several years, a decade to actually get across the finish line. And, you know, oftentimes in very limited ways. I think particularly with our casita legislation, that's going to be the most impactful version of that bill that we've seen throughout the country. I think you're going to have a lot of families be able to build those units and, you know, provide housing for their young kids who are heading off to school or for their aging parents. And then with that missing middle, you know, I think that's going to be the duplexes and triplexes. I think that's going to be a little bit more time. But luckily, you know, we're going to see the ability to build more housing within single family zoned areas, which is 80% of our available housing land.
Paul, this issue, though, was not without its controversy. I mean, the governor vetoed a bill called the Arizona Starter Homes Act. And, you know, there was a lot of sort of negotiation going on to get these bills across the finish line. Do you see this as an issue that will continue to be doable, but maybe not super easy to get done?
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, especially you're working, you know, we represent the League of Cities and Towns and do a lot of work in that space. And, you know, cities and towns are each individual and unique, and these top-down mandates don't work for every single community. In fact, working, it's another spot where there's a good opportunity for negotiation if people will come to the table to negotiate and discuss. I think there's additional solutions that can be made, but it's not just a one size fits all. I always think it's funny that the legislature complains about the federal government and how much they don't like getting mandates from the feds, but then they want to mandate what the cities and towns do on things like housing and a wide variety of other issues as well. And so I think it will be best done if they can work together, not adversarially, but in conjunction to find solutions.
How significant, Paul, do you think the bills that pass this year will be in terms of trying to alleviate the housing shortage in the state?
I think they're a step in the right direction. We still have housing challenges in addition to not only availability, but I mean I think it's something along the lines of 30,000 multifamily units that are not built because of supply chain, construction issues, workforce issues. Mm-hmm. So it's not even just that we can't get the things, you know, more. It's that the things that are in the pipeline are being held up as well.
Gael, there was an issue that came up later in the session that I think maybe some people didn't expect to come up this session, which is the state's 1864 ban on abortion, near total ban on abortion. What did you make of all of the debate and discussion and controversy around the efforts to repeal that law?
I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, with the result we saw of repealing that ban, we saw the first step in shifting the tide of, you know, decades, you know, centuries of anti-abortion policy within Arizona, and an understanding of the popularity and the importance that abortion rights has among voters here. And I think, you know, it was kind of surprising even at the end of the day to see not just see it get done, but to see the fierce opposition from members of the Republican caucus to hold the line on a position that less than 10%. I don't know, Paul, you're the pollster. I think the highest I ever saw it at was 8% of Arizona voters were supporting that extreme hardline no abortion position. But at the end of the day, seeing that ban get repealed, I think, was the first piece. And I think in November, you're going to see voters approve the abortion access proposition.
Paul, we saw a lot of shouting, I guess. We can legitimately say shouting on the House floor,
yes.
Actual shouting. There were a lot of debates and criticisms and speeches about what people believed and what the appropriate steps were to take. How much do you anticipate the debate over the 1864 law will play in maybe even later this month during the primaries, but especially in November and with, as Gael mentioned, with the measure presumably on the ballot?
So two things. 70% of voters were less likely to support a candidate who wanted to criminalize abortion, and only 22% in a recent poll from a year or so ago wanted abortion to be banned and criminalized. It is a narrow segment. I said at the time that Republicans it was a disaster for them. The dog caught the car and then they didn't know what to do. And I think, you know, we saw some of the more centrist Republicans, those from the swing districts, recognized right away they needed to do something. And so you saw the repeal and we're back to eventually, whenever it goes into effect, 15 weeks. But I think it was a turbo boost for the statewide initiative. I think they're going to file a record number of signatures this week, and we'll see the final number there. And but it will be impactful. I don't know as much in the primary, but I certainly think the position on these abortion issues, some of these votes are going to come back to haunt some of these candidates in the general election.
Really? In terms of those who voted against repealing the law?
I think so. But more the candidates that really pushed for it and, you know, were maybe in the past trying to boost their abortion credentials for Republicans now are going to some of their positions and even if they voted to repeal, it's going to haunt them because it's going to be an issue that comes up, especially in these really critically tight races.
One of the biggest issues of the year was border security, both nationally and here in Arizona. GOP lawmakers sent the governor a bill dealing with that, which she vetoed. Legislative Republicans then decided to go around her and sent a measure to the ballot. I asked Paul, assuming the proposal survives legal challenges and is on the November ballot, what kind of impact it'll have on turnout and results this fall.
It's a big deal for Republicans. Immigration is still the top issue facing the state with about 36.6% saying it's their number one issue. But underneath those numbers, the bigger number is 63% of Republicans say immigration is their top issue. And so when you see, as we just previously talked about, the abortion issue is going to be on the ballot, that's going to be a large turnout mechanism for progressive leaning voters, for younger leaning voters. This is an opportunity for Republicans to put something on the ballot that should help with Republicans. They're clearly fed up with some of these immigration issues, and this is sort of the way they can address it and make it an accomplishment that they're doing something. We saw this a lot in the early to mid-2000s. Republicans year after year would put some sort of immigration issue on the ballot, mm-hmm. whether it was official English or some other items they've done over the years as sort of a backstop to sort of increase enthusiasm. I think it also gives them something for the president to talk – former President Trump to talk about when he's in town. Maybe he gets off of stolen elections and things that are not popular and instead makes it about immigration. I think that is helpful for him in a swing state.
Do you think that the border issue for Republicans is as motivating or less motivating or the same amount of motivating as the abortion issue is to Democrats?
Probably less, slightly less, just because abortion is a very emotional issue. It is still a big issue from Republicans. What is funny is we just finished the polling for the Center for the Future of Arizona, and one of the things that we found is actually there was a significant amount of support for enacting comprehensive immigration reform, including a pathway to citizenship. And that's not something anybody's talking about, and even 61% of Republicans supported that. There are policies that we could be passing that large majorities of Arizonans and voters agree upon, not necessarily what the Republicans placed on the ballot, but there are immigration issues where there's some commonalities.
Well, Gail, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of being able to do big things and find common agreement on areas, even within controversial issues like immigration, like border security, that, you know, Democrats and Republicans can both get on board with.
Yeah. And I'm glad, Paul, you brought up that poll because it's in alignment with a lot of other polling I've seen, which is voters are tired of this, you know, quote unquote, tough on immigration line. We've seen it here for 20 years and they've seen how it doesn't work and how it's just a platform for demagogues. You know, they're tired of the Joe Arpaios of the world. And I actually think that that's going to be harmful in the long run for them, because what people want is a balanced approach. They want an understanding that there are people here who contribute to our society and to their community. They want that pathway to citizenship. They want these real solutions and these real answers. And they get tired of candidates just promising this one hammer approach. And I think we already have seen this with this referral to the ballot. We have, you know, Republican border sheriffs who have come out and said, you know, what do you expect me to do with this? How the heck am I supposed to enforce this thing? It's going to cost too much money. It's you know, unconstitutional, right? Like there's all sorts of arguments against it. I don't think it'll survive legal challenges. But once again, I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's about trying to mobilize voters.
So this was one of a number of ballot measures that legislative Republicans sent to the ballot, ostensibly to get around what they assumed Governor Hobbs would veto. Gail, what kind of impact do you think all of those measures, besides it making the ballot really, really long, what kind of impact do you think those measures might have on the rest of the election in November?
Yeah, I think, you know, Arizona voters, they'll vote at the top of the ticket and then they'll flip it over and they'll really focus on those propositions. They take their responsibility on these very seriously. And I think the Republican legislature thought they could kind of once again pull one over on the voters here by submitting so many things that it clogs it up. I think those voters will be very annoyed by that and very annoyed with the legislators specifically who did it. But I think they're going to know what they prioritize. They're going to prioritize access to abortion rights. You know, they're going to they know these initiatives that they signed the petition for to get on the ballot. So I think the legislature is going to be in for a rude awakening for all these various priorities, particularly this insane one on judicial retention, where they're just trying to protect their buddies on the state Supreme Court who made a frankly extreme decision that nobody wanted. And I think that's going to really backfire, not only for the legislators and that initiative, but for those justices.
Paul, do you agree with that? Do you think that even sort of the lower profile initiatives, you know, not the border and not abortion, those might be motivating to some voters?
Certainly. I think the Make Elections Fair initiative, which is also filing signatures to change our election system, is going to motivate folks. I think the legislature saw that, and that's why they're trying to codify the partisan primaries as one of the other things that they placed on the ballot. I don't think people are very happy with our partisan primary system right now. And so I suspect that one's not likely to pass. I sort of look at it a slightly different way. I think they put these things on and hope to slide one past the goalie. And we saw in 2022, they put several issues on the ballot, including that 60% for a tax increase.
Yeah.
And that one, the rest of them failed, but that one passed narrowly. And I think sort of the strategy might be, and I don't talk to them about this, but the strategy might be, let's put several things on and see if something – see what sticks, see if anything passes. And otherwise, maybe crowd that ballot so that it maybe suppresses that interest and maybe suppresses interest in the abortion issue. But the issue is voters are going to find the abortion issue no matter what. They're going to seek it out and vote on it. I don't think there's anything they could really do to suppress that.
They do love voter suppression.
So I want to ask you both about one of the busier committees at the legislature this year, which I think was not one that many people had on their bingo card, which were the ethics committees, especially later on in the session. It seemed like there were investigations coming up all over the place. Paul, how much of this was related to maybe some of the chaos and the turnover that Gael had mentioned a little bit earlier? How much of it was maybe just they'd been in session last year for a really long time? This year was another long session. People just have bad tempers at that point, just kind of sick of each other?
Yeah, and I also just think it's the tenor and tone of politics these days. I don't think we – for years and years, we didn't see a lot of ethics investigation, a lot of people forcibly removed from the legislature. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, we've seen quite a bit. And then we see not only a significant amount of turnover this year, but we also see a large number of good people who announce that they're not going to run again. It's a very difficult job. I think it's thankless in a lot of ways. The pay is low. Voters always reject the legislative pay increase.
Yeah.
I think it's a difficult place to – and then tempers arise and you sort of – there's that tit for tat. If somebody is getting investigated on one side or alleging against one group, then you sort of see the backlash from the other side trying to kind of make things even.
Gael, was it apparent in the kinds of policies, the kinds of bills that came up that there had been so much turnover, there were so many new faces in the legislature?
Honestly, I think a lot of the new members did a really great job of adjusting themselves quickly and really took it to heart of, hey, I need to really do my research, buckle down, read some bills. I was really impressed with how a lot of them approached the work. And I think that says a lot both about the people who put themselves forward through that process, but also, the expectations that they had for themselves. And I think they hadn't yet gotten to the point of being exhausted with the process because they all came in so late. So sometimes they had a fresh perspective and were able to approach issues with, an open mind.
Did it surprise you the frequency with which ethics committees had to meet this year?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think we saw a real unfortunate weaponization of that process, particularly towards Representative Ortiz and De Los Santos, who were investigated for chanting shame during the abortion.
But that was one where even the Democrats on the committee voted that they had violated the rules.
Yeah, I think, with the ethics committee votes, there's a real sort of kind of pro forma unity that happens there. I think that those members were trying to keep the peace and maybe hope that with that vote it would go away. And, that's unfortunate because I don't think that in the long term will serve that process. I think we need to have a little bit of a higher standard for these things because there have been some really nasty instances over the last several years, Don Shooter, David Stringer. And I think we need to keep our focus on what is really damaging to the body, the legislative body, the working environment there, and the harm that can be done, how do we appropriately manage that as, or how do they appropriately manage that as legislators?
Sure.
I think the other thing is it's a reflection of our national politics. I mean, we have a former president who's under got convicted and is under an indictment, and then you've got trying to turn around and do the same thing to Hunter Biden and make this about people. It's sort of any sort of negativity. We see it sort of at the national level. So they're trying to attach it here as well. It's definitely been weaponized. I agree completely. The weaponization of it, it's like the impeachment. I think at some point we're going to see impeachments as something that is just another element of political theater. I think it's going to lose a lot of its teeth the way that it's been used so often. And I think the ethics investigations are going down that road as well.
Interesting. All right. So, guys, we have just a couple minutes left. I want to look forward a little bit. There's been a lot of chatter that Democrats might be able to win one or both of the legislative chambers. This has, of course, been a goal for many, many years. Governor Hobbs has made it one of her priorities to make that happen. Paul, when we reconvene for the legislature in January, who controls the House and Senate?
That's a great question. I think there's a highly likelihood that the Senate will be split 15-15.
Okay.
And that'll be the most interesting.
That is very interesting.
Because that would be then a governing coalition would have to come together to select a president. You'd have co-chairs for committees and things like that. I think that would be the biggest outcome. We haven't had that happen since 2000. And so I think that's probably the greatest likelihood. On the House side, at the moment, I sort of see the Republicans and Democrats swapping a seat, one that's in Republican control but in a Democratic-leaning district and vice versa. I think they switched those. So right now it's potentially still a one-vote Republican advantage because some of those incumbents that I think Democrats were relying on to flip the House aren't staying, and so there's new people in those races. So you can't assume that they're going to hold on to some of these seats that they've held on to in the past. So it'll be interesting to watch, but I definitely think there's a good chance the Senate is split.
Okay, what do you think? House and Senate, who controls them in January?
I am really hoping it's the Democratic caucus for once, just, you know, just so that I can have a new thing to work with. You know, I need some different form of excitement down there. And, you know, I think to Paul's point, you know, there's a lot of opportunity on the Senate side, and I think that's where you're seeing a lot of the investment start. But I think there has been a really ambitious strategy from the Democrats on the House side. You know, they're playing in more districts than you've seen before. I think, you know, they're targeting some districts that Republicans may not think are really a real fight, but that they've got really strong candidates in. And so I think you're going to see a real chance there. And of course, to Paul's point earlier on abortion votes, we definitely saw some Republicans in those competitive districts take some really bad votes this year. And I don't think they're going to be able to escape that albatross around their neck.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Gael Esposito of Creosote Partners, Paul Bentz of High Ground, thanks to you both for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.